Okay, welcome back for some extra. Thank you, Cheryl, Debbie, and Ben for being with us. I was just going to start off by saying, you know, Cheryl, this business of refusal based on the idea of future publication, this is not just the MHRA does this. Excuse me, I have an FOI who I've been pursuing the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for quite some time now because they used to publish their spending records for every spend that over £25,000, and they stopped doing it just before the Ukraine war started. So I put in an FOI asking for it, and they said, "Oh no, that's scheduled for future publication, so it's not within the, it's not in the public interest for it to give it to you now when it's going to be public. We'll wait for the official look." And of course, they said it would be in early 2024. Early 2024 has come and gone, and still hasn't been published.
The difference, Mike, is this is in the last 3 years since they had this information, a lot of babies have been born, a lot of women have got pregnant, and they've all been encouraged to have injections. And I went with a friend to a gynae outpatient clinic, and the poster was life-size on the wall advising the pregnant people sat around me that they should be vaccinated. It's going on still.
Yes.
Have we forgotten thalidomide? You know, and what's even worse is that Dame June Rain, you know, she was head of pharmacovigilance. That was her role before she was CEO. She was the one that presented the homage to Sir Alistair Breckinridge, where she reminded everybody of the disaster that was thalidomide. Pregnant women should have seen this data 3 years ago. The fact that it's being held onto and might never be seen again, as Professor Fenton said, we might never get to see it. Pregnant women are today, tomorrow, next week, they're still being jabbed. In my day, and I'm sure a lot of ladies that are watching of a similar age, remember that as when we were pregnant, we weren't allowed to drink, we weren't allowed to eat soft cheese, we had to be really careful if we went to to domestic animals and stuff, listeria. It was, you know, we weren't allowed anything. And all of a sudden, thalidomide is being forgotten, and now we are using an experimental injection that is known to be very dangerous. We're still rolling it out on pregnant women when we don't need to be. We don't need to be. And
it's not been forgotten, Debbie. It's not been forgotten. They know, like, this is, you know, the assumption has to be that they're deliberately ignoring it.
That's why they shut the monitor down.
Sorry, Cheryl.
They must have shut the monitor down because they started seeing the results they didn't want.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, at the end of the day, it took 5 years to get the thalidomide recognition that it was doing what it was doing. And that was before you had computers. That was when it was word of mouth and doctors talking to each other. Now we've got a lot of data that's showing this evidence, and they've probably stopped the data actually existing anymore because they don't want to see it. And we're now, 3 years along?
And my question would be, have they shut it down, or are they just saying they've shut it down? But to come back to, I want to put this back on screen again from Ben's report. And Ben, my first question is that graph doing that because people have been moved from one benefit onto another? Or is that graph like that because that's when vaccination began?
I believe it's because it's when vaccination began. I think that PIP is just a rebranding of the disability allowance. So it's not a new thing. It's just they changed the name of it essentially. Yeah. Which is one of these things that they love to do because it's like, oh well, we can't possibly compare the data between this period and that period because we don't have that same thing anymore. You know, it's just another method of, what is it? I called it governance by plausible deniability. That's what we've got.
Well, it seems to me that graph, you know, that is a smoking gun right there, is how it looks to me. Yep. We've got Lord Bethell saying that we've got, what did you say, 10% of the population working age population?
3 million people, more than 3 million people signed off permanent sick.
I mean, aside from being a massive burden on the taxpayer, the remaining taxpayer, it's an absolute devastating travesty for the people that are affected by this.
And it is. It's an absolute catastrophe. It's a human catastrophe. Like this entire process, and we're seeing. You know, this is the delayed reaction of what was going on 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and it's now. This is the beginning, really, of us seeing the impact.
Right. And I do not understand. Cheryl, just make this point before it falls out, because things fall out my brains these days. I do not understand why every single person watching this program or every single person that's seen that graph isn't banging down the doors of their local constituency offices, banging down the doors of their local journalist, their local newspaper, whoever it happens to be, and saying, why aren't you looking at this? Why aren't you covering it in detail? Why aren't you responding to it? I find it absolutely outrageous. That graphic, I find outrageous. And everybody should be absolutely, incandescent with rage about it, is how I feel. But anyway.
Absolutely.
And Cheryl, you go.
I mean, is that an Ed Dowd graph as far as I
yeah, it's Dowd, yeah.
I mean, and in America, he's got the same disability figures. You know, they've got the same sort of increases as well. So disablement, and you're talking about working age people, you're talking about people who are 18 to 64 who shouldn't be getting ill like this.
Tragedy of it, but what they're going to promote ultimately, because they've already been talking about it, right? You know, like this will be an excuse for mass immigration. Oh well, everyone's sick, so they can't work, so we need to bring in, you know, several million migrants to do the work that these people were supposed to be doing. You know, the whole thing correlates. Yeah, it's all designed to deliver the outcome that they're looking for. You know, and it's hideous, really, when you understand it.
So, Ben's right. PIP, personal independence payment, has taken over from disability living allowance. And what happened when the transfer of the benefit DLA went into PIP is that many actually lost their benefits. So the numbers started to go down because they weren't accepted onto the new PIP scheme. But aside that, it also links in very well. All of this links in very well to what Alison Cave was saying at the MHRA board meeting when she was talking about the yellow card biobank, because last year, adverse events, so injuries from pharmaceuticals resulted or contributed to 16.5% of hospital admissions. Now, this costs the NHS $2.21 billion. So 20 to 50% of adverse reactions, they think they can reduce by everybody volunteering their adverse reactions to the biobank where they can be genomically sequenced, which of course, genomic sequence, yellow card biobank, adverse reactions, that is all linked in to Genomics England, which is Sir John Bell. And Sir John Bell is attached to the hip to Lord Bethel. So you can see where the revolving door is starting to go. And it was interesting listening to what Professor Fenton was saying about the UK HSA, because we know that the UK HSA is basically spooks. You know, that they're basically spooks. It's where Public Health England have fused with security. But there's also a common denominator with the MHRA as well and the UK HSA in that Raj Long from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who's on the board of the MHRA, is also on the board of the UK HSA. So all of these tracks you can follow, and it's quite intricate. But it all comes back to the fact, I'm afraid, is that pregnant women are getting jabbed as we are sitting here today, and they should not be. Correct, Cheryl?
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's been known for some time that it affects the placenta, and therefore these problems will occur. And, you know, it's so disgusting because the whole thing was set up. The 1968 Medicine Act was set up after thalidomide, and one of the main things was to protect pregnancy. Mm. And out of that came eventually the MHRA. And what they're doing, they're not protecting pregnant ladies. And they're covering
up the information. How many cases, Cheryl, how many cases of thalidomide was it before it was stopped?
I can't remember the exact number.
It was 500. It was 500 cases of thalidomide, and then the whole lot was dropped and the yellow card system was brought in. We are now looking, well, we don't know, do we, because the MHRA aren't publishing the data anymore, but we know that there are hundreds of thousands of serious adverse reactions. And at the last count, there was well over 2,000 deaths, and we're still rolling it out. And there's more coming down the pipeline.
And everything in the past was always considered a problem if there'd been less than 50 deaths. So you've got a situation whereby all these things should have been stopped some time ago. And all the ones that are, we keep saying it, don't we? All the ones that are in the pipeline for whether they be infectious control or for cancer, they're all based on the same technology that we know there's a major problem with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole biotechnological industry that they want to build on the back of RNA technology and genomics, genetic engineering. I mean, they got the whole thing stitched up already, basically. I think the idea that it's so perverse and cynical and awful the way they talk about this stuff. So, like, the idea that they're building this biobank so that they can predict whether you're likely to have an adverse reaction to the experiment that they're going to put you in. It's completely 180 degrees in the wrong direction, in the opposite direction to what they're supposed to be doing. Every single component of this.
Yeah, climate change is down to humans, and anybody who gets a reaction to a drug, it's because there's something wrong with you as a human, rather than something wrong with the drug that's causing major problems in lots of people.
And we've got a pharmaceutical industrial complex that thinks that it has the right to carry out mass experimentation. Like, who the hell are these people? Where on earth do they think that they get the license to do this? It is absolutely outrageous.
No, Ben, this is ridiculous. They paid for it. They've paid for it, and they get it. That's it. They paid for it. It's theirs.
We are raw materials in their profit machine. Yeah, we are the raw material. The British population is the raw material in the pharmaceutical industry's
your DNA.
Profit engine. Yeah,
it's not just data they're stealing. It's not just data. Yeah. It's DNA, because the whole aim of this yellow card biobank is to identify genomic markers that may put people at risk of certain adverse reactions. But, you know, when you were listening to Professor Norman Fenton, I don't know if anybody else picked up, but I could see and I could hear the frustration, the anger in his demeanor, in his voice at what is going on. Because quite clearly, I mean, I honestly thought that when they started rolling out the jab to pregnant women, I thought people would wake up. I thought this is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Now we're going to start injecting pregnant women, unborn babies and children. People are going to wake up. When they didn't, I was shocked. And I literally feel shaking. I'm shaking with rage. The fact that we know the MHRA has got data, and Cheryl, for the last 18 months, has been banging on their doors to get this data, and they are deliberately withholding it. And the big question is, well, if they didn't have anything to hide, they wouldn't be withholding it, would they? Would they?
Hold on. It's my turn. My turn. Right. Debbie, you just said, right, because I'm going to say personalized medicine would be a great idea if we were living in a benevolent society. But yes, the people behind this are malevolent. And then it is not a good idea. Because what you're talking about, if they're saying we can we want to do these studies so that we can prevent adverse reactions in the people that have been getting adverse reactions, well, actually, what happens if they're identifying markers which would allow a particular effect in a much broader population? What happens if they want to choose black people or people that have Down syndrome or people that have a particular genetic issue for removal from the gene pool? This is the issue as far as I'm concerned, because I have...
No, they're eugenicists. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We should be concerned about that. But it's an interesting point you raised there. The idea that in a benevolent society, it'd be all right to do this. I think in a truly benevolent society, that pharmaceuticals wouldn't be necessary. I honestly feel like they wouldn't exist at all.
Fair point.
I don't think we have the capability, and you listen to Hedley Reese, of actually making these personalised medicines, right? Because you're talking about hospitals making very, very delicate things that they don't have the facilities to actually manufacture the things properly for each individual person. And the other thing is you've got about 19,000 genes in a human, and we've got about 2 million proteins, and genes code for proteins. So you don't have one gene coding for one protein. You might think that that gene is at fault because that protein's at fault. But by doing something with that gene, what else are you actually affecting? And that's the problem. So, I mean, a basic example would be something like a non-steroidal. A non-steroidal was basically introduced to reduce inflammation. So it's the prostaglandins they knew actually reduced inflammation. So we'll reduce prostaglandins and we'll stop the inflammation happening. But it also was gastroprotective. And therefore, when you took your non-steroidal, you could have a stomach problem because it's going to affect your lining of your gut that the prostaglandin was trying to protect. So you've got to know all the effects of all these proteins that you're trying to change, and all these genes and all the proteins that it's affecting, as to whether you're going to have the effect that you want. And I suggest that they don't do that. They just think, oh, it's that. Oh, we'll do something about that. And we forget all the rest of the things. And that's why you get your side effects. Sorry, it's one of my soapbox moments.
They're like mad scientists, like with some crazy experiment. You couldn't make it up, really. Can I ask a quick question just to clarify on one thing that you were talking about? Because when you said it, I couldn't quite believe it, which is, I mean, there were a number of things I couldn't quite believe. But one of them is that they're saying that they need to peer review the data before it's released. Is that what they're saying? That's completely unprecedented, right? That you don't do that. We just want a raw data set. You don't need to peer review it, right? This is a nonsense.
That's what I've kept asking them about, because obviously you've got your yellow card being produced on a regular basis, or it was, so that you had all that data. This is just data that you know a little bit more about the people that are providing that data. Why should it have to be peer-reviewed? But you have to be peer-reviewed to put it in a scientific publication, and they want to put it in a scientific publication. And it's just a stalling tactic.
No, you don't peer-review. But you don't peer-review the data. You peer-review the interpretation, your interpretation of the data. You peer-review.
Exactly.
Right?
that's the whole thing.
It's gaslighting. It's like, what? You're just making stuff up at this point. It's nutty. Although,
it's rubbish.
I suppose the bit that's slightly encouraging is that is total, outright, last resort desperation if they're at that point.
Yeah. And as Professor Fenton says, you know, we can keep saying, oh, we're going to publish. But when? I mean, if it doesn't happen in 3 years' time, what do we do then? You've got 3 more years of pregnant ladies getting pregnant. You know, it's sacrilege. It's awful.
or been in a nuclear war with Russia by that point, so don't worry about it.
We're all right. We'll be wiped out, so it doesn't matter.
Let's not forget, pregnant women were never included in any of the trial work previously. There's been no research data on pregnant women. There's no long-term data on these injections for anybody. There is no data. So, I mean,
There was eight rats, Debbie.
They all died, didn't they? They all died.
They got rid of them very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, but what we've done is we've gone from something called pharmacovigilance, which is looking out for medicines. That's the PEAG groups, the pharmacovigilance expert advisory groups. We've gone from that field now to something called pharmacogenomics, so pharmacogenetics. So we've gone to a completely new field of pharmacology, if you like. It is a whole new brand, an industry.
Yeah. Yeah, which has been made up because it's brand spanking, right? Like this never existed before. Can I address the elephant in the room? There's a big sort of gaping gap in what we're talking about here. We talked a lot about pregnant women, but is there any data on the pregnant men?
Ben, women get pregnant, men do not get pregnant. End of. Only women get pregnant. There are two genders, male and female.
It's 2024.
No. It could be 20. It could be 21, 24. Women get pregnant.
No. Hold on a second, Debbie. No. We've just been talking for the last 20 minutes about genetic engineering, and now you're trying to claim that only women can get pregnant. This is in 2020. In 100 years' time, it's going to be no problem.
Stop it, Mr. Robinson. Stop it. It's before the weekend. We all need to chill. I can feel the rage. You're doing this on purpose.
Yeah. The monitor had 30,000 in it. So presumably some of them have been men, women, and everybody else. Yeah. You'd be able to have a look at the data if you got it.
Cheryl, seriously, though, on a serious note, what next? Because you've been banging the door down for nearly 2 years now. I mean, what happens next? Norman's put his Substack out, but is there any form of appeal, recourse?
Yes, you can go and do a tribunal. You can go and take it further with the ICO.
But that's going to take another 10 years.
Well, I mean, Norman's already said, is there any point? But it's interesting if you look at his Substack of how people have responded to it. And there's a lot of information in there that people have given. And one in particular was saying, go forward with it, keep taking it forward.
But my view on this, Cheryl, is that you don't stop. You have to be like the Terminator. You never stop.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah.
Right, and
even if it does me in, yeah.
I'll tell you why you don't stop because a good friend of ours told us this years ago. If you stop, if you've gone through a freedom of information process and freedom of information, let's not be beat around the bush, but it is a drag. It is an absolute drag because you got to wait 20 working days and then they don't give you what you want. So you got to wait and you got to wait. And it's just a waiting game, right? And it's totally understandable that people would just throw their hands up in the air and say, bollocks to this. It's a waste of time. But the problem is that this is part of the game. And if people drop the thing after a period of time and give up on it, that sets a precedent. So whatever excuse they give, they will then use the same mechanism the next time or the next time and the next time. So it's actually incumbent upon us to see it through as absolutely as far as we can go with it and not let it drop.
Yeah.
If they were actually interested in the things that they say that they're interested in around safety, then there would be a live feed publicly available to all of the data coming out of the system that you could just go and look at right now. that none of this bureaucracy would exist. The only reason it's there is to provide cover for the people committing, frankly, the crimes inside the health system. Right? There's no reason at all why we shouldn't be able to see all of this information, and we should have been able to see it all the way along through the process. And in fact, actually, the MHRA should just be a bunch of APIs. We should just be able to go and plug in, pull data out that's coming into their system, and have total and full transparency. But there shouldn't be another way of doing it.
Yeah, the thing that was awful was June Rain in November 22 actually spouting forth about this monitor as if it was the best thing since sliced bread, and that she got this pregnancy data and what have you. And that was, if they had stopped it after 7 months, that was way after. You know, it was when they'd actually presented to the PEAG and all that information had been presented in the report that they sent to us. It's just ridiculous that she's lying. She's lying. She's standing there in a presentation in front of a large group of people telling stories.
Mm. Yeah, total psychopaths.
Mm. And don't forget the PEAG, the Pharmacovigilance Expert Advisory Group, that is part of the Commission for Human Medicines. And, of course, we go back then to Professor Munir Pirmohamed. And I haven't forgotten Professor Munir Pirmohamed, because we all focus in on Dame June Rain, quite rightly, and Alison Cave and Graham Cook and all the rest of them in the MHRA. But we really mustn't forget the Commission for Human Medicines at the top of the pyramid, because Professor Munir Pirmohamed, he's the one that advises ministers direct. So let's not take him off our radar either.
Does that bring us to a natural end for this segment?
Oh, I could go on forever if you like. Where do you want me to start?
Right. Well, let's start with what is the physical address of the MHRA?
It's in Canary Wharf, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They moved into the European Medicines Agency was based at Canary Wharf. But when we left the European Union, obviously the EMA moved out and the MHRA moved in. And it's interesting location, because Canary Wharf, I wrote an article, it's on the website, it's called Canary in the Coal Mine. And Canary Wharf is designated to be the Europe's biggest wet lab. And also they're building accommodation for over 2,000 scientists to be literally on site. So Canary Wharf is an area to keep your eyes on. And of course the MHRA are right in the middle of it.
So we should have 500,000 people outside that building?
Yes.
Well,
absolutely.
I went down there. God, when was it? 2 years ago? I can't remember the exact date. It's a couple of years ago now. We went down. There was a base, and actually a bunch of people got into the offices, right? And there was a big protest.
You were the one that put June Rain underneath her desk.
Yeah,
you were the one that scared her.
Yeah, I was down there. Yeah, 100%. We almost got in the building. Like, seriously, the police almost seriously lost control of that situation, right? I mean, it was pretty full on, yeah. So there was probably, I don't know, probably not more than 1,000 people, maybe even like 500, 600, 700, something like that, who went down there. June Rain was hiding under a desk and we weren't going to do anything violent, but it was like, we know where you live, right? There needs to be a process of direct action. And again, it's not an exhortation to violence at all, right? But people have got to start making the people who are behind this feel the heat a little bit. Right. And because at the minute they're just hiding behind their YouTube board meetings and being whisked around town in private cars. And, you know, they've got their ministerial passes that get them into the bits of SW1 that no one else can access. And, you know, they're not being held to account.
So this is the danger of not having a functioning or of having a co-opted mainstream media. Because if you've got a mainstream, if there's no way for the public voice to be heard through the mass media, forget about the independent media or the alternative media, but through the mass media, if there's no way, if they're excluding the public voice, then the public are going to start taking action in their own hands. And at this point in time, that's being expressed through the likes of the UK column and everybody else that's out there that's speaking out. And it's being expressed through occasional public protest with relatively small numbers. But I've got to say that at some point, inevitably, the frustration is going to boil over. And there's going to be no responsibility for that other than with the people that are pushing these policies and that are and with the mainstream press and with the politicians and so on. So this isn't this isn't that the public is becoming a bunch of extremists. The extremists are in positions of authority at the moment, and the public are becoming increasingly impatient with their voices not being heard. And so, you know, I chose the figure 500,000. I would prefer to see 5 million people camped outside that building. I would love to see half the population of this country camped outside the Houses of Parliament, and those people not being told in no uncertain terms, no, you will listen to us. I was going to say something that I'm not allowed to say on the UK column. You will listen to us for once. This is what's needed. And violence, I think, is not the answer. It's never the answer, but that kind of determination is.
Yep.
But if you had 5 million people, then you wouldn't need to be violent. You've got the bulk of a number. But Dan Austin Gregory last night, if you remember, Ben, he was promoting a rally that he's doing to get everybody to go to the WHO building. So they're going to set off and have a kind of chuckers thing, ordinary people going off to the WHO.
Right. So
the main thing, and I remember actually talking to someone on the outside the MHRA building about this exact topic 2 years ago. Right. Which is that I think that that's a good thing to do. I don't know the detail of what Dan Austin Gregory is proposing to do. Right. But I certainly think, you know, having I just said it right, like I think that we need to start holding people to account more directly. But we got to expand on numbers, and we got to get away from the same old faces. Going on these marches around central London and no one knowing about it, right? Like the actual you've got a direct outreach, going into the counties, going into the towns, going into the estates, particularly in central London. You've got huge estates all over the place which are full of people who are completely disconnected from everything, really. I mean, they're not paying attention to mainstream media, and they can very clearly and obviously see what's going on. We're looking at, you know, rapidly accelerating societal collapse that has been deliberately inflicted on us by the health system and the people running all of the institutions. And most people know exactly what's happening. Yeah, but they don't know what to do about it. And no one's providing them a pressure valve, like a release valve for it. And actually, what the establishment would love to happen is for things to descend into violence, and they're going to provoke us on an ongoing basis to try to ratchet up the pressure to make that happen. Because if it descends into violence, then that will give them all the license that they need to bring in greater restrictions, greater infringements on civil liberties, digital ID systems, stop people moving around the city, you know, if things start to get violent, because they'll just be able to turn around to the mainstream of the country and say, oh, look, it's all breaking down. And it's nothing to do with us, obviously. It's got to do with, you know, these awful people in London. And, you know, we've got to bring in all these new restrictions to deal with the situation without any admission of culpability on their own part, right? So it's something that's got to be managed very carefully. But thankfully, it feels like things are heading in the right direction. And actually, as I was saying earlier on, if they are at the level where they are telling us with a straight face that they have to peer review a data set before they can release it, then that's like they haven't got anything left. There's nothing left after that point.
Yeah.
They're just making it up right now. Like there's no stage beyond that for them.
Yeah.
100%. Can I make a final suggestion?
It would need to be the final one, yes.
Can I make a final suggestion? See what people think in the chat box for this. So Dame June Rain, she's going to be going soon. She's the rat that's leaving the sinking ship, remember? So she's resigned from the MHRA. And Tess Laurie, you know, bringing it back, excuse me, bringing it back to Ben's segment in the news. Tess has been doing an awful lot. And she's also put a template letter up, a notice of liability, a liability order for Dame June Rain. How about we all write a liability order to her, post it by Royal Mail snail mail on a yellow card, photograph it as you're putting it through the post box or sending it, and let's deluge her with yellow cards before she leaves the MHRA.
I think that is an excellent idea. I thought you were going to say for a second there that we should put Tess Laurie in instead of June Rain.
Yes, I'd love to see Tess Laurie delivering sacks of yellow cards to Dame June Rain. What a lovely final leaving present. Because you know what? In the reward scheme that we showed on the main news, the staff are getting rewards. They don't just get a virtual bunch of flowers, a £50 or a £100 voucher, you know. They get a personal letter from Dame June Rain herself. So I think we need to send June Rain off in style. What do you think?
Everybody thinks it's a great idea. So maybe we should get the cards. Maybe we should get the cards made.
Yellow cards with the notice on. Yes.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Oh, I'm excited now.
Look, we got to leave that there for today with that idea. Thank you very much, Cheryl. Thanks, Debbie and Ben. Thanks for everybody that's been watching. It's much appreciated. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.